State Police Boston recorded emergency 510.
My wife just shot, I just shot.
Where is this, sir?
I have no idea. I'm off. I've been coming from Fremont, bringing the women's hospital.
He was very conversant and lucid in giving the Boston police officers quite a bit of information about what had transpired. And I was impressed with how much detail and how much recall he had, considering what he had been through.
Tearful family and friends said goodbye to Carol Stewart on October 28th, 5 days after she and her husband Chuck had been found shot in the Mission Hill section of Boston. At the time, he had told police a black man had shot them. Their families grieved for them and the loss of their prematurely born son, Christopher.
It's things like that happen to a lot of people, and you just never think it's going to happen to you, and it's reality. That's just the way it is.
But that's not the way it was. Shortly after he picked a suspect out of a lineup, Stewart's bizarre tale began to unravel. He became the suspect after his brother Matthew, reportedly driven by a guilty conscience, went to the police. Within hours of being told he was a suspect, he was dead. He jumped to his death from the Tobin Bridge, taking with him valuable pieces of a distorted puzzle.
Welcome to this Friday night edition of True Crime Brewery, Deadly Greed, the murders of Carol and Christopher Stewart. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick. This is the second of three husband murdering wives stories we're going to do.
I call it the Killer Husband series.
Right.
Yeah. So this is number two, as Dick just said, and this is about Charles Stewart.
And this was a very famous case here in New England.
Yes.
I had moved back to Maine 2 years before this occurred, and living just an hour from Boston, this was a huge, huge case.
Well, I think it's really interesting. We've got a lot of stuff to talk about.
Okay.
Okay. So when the public first heard Charles Stewart's voice on the 911 call that he made the evening of October 23rd, 1989, the reaction was one of shock and sympathy. A film crew from the TV show Rescue 911, and that was with William Shatner as the host. They were riding along with Boston EMS that night, and they captured an EMS response on camera to the shooting.
Right.
Now, as Charles was strapped into a gurney and put into the ambulance, he could be overheard giving details of the crime to police. A policeman asks, "Who was it? Was it a white guy?" And Charles answers, "He was a black man." So Charles Stewart's tragic story gained widespread public sympathy, and police began a citywide search for the shooter. Described by Charles as a black man with a raspy voice, wearing a black tracksuit with two or three red stripes on the sleeves.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And they were found in a predominantly black neighborhood.
Yes, so. Well, he purposely went into a bad neighborhood.
Right.
Yeah. According to the New York Times, the investigation of this crime was responsible for instantly igniting the racial tension beneath the surface of daily life in Boston and, for that matter, most of America. So the shock of the crime led to a police crackdown, and more than 100 officers were assigned to scour Mission Hill, Roxbury, and Mattapan for the suspect. Was Charles Stewart's plot to kill his wife so brilliant that the entire city of Boston was fooled? Or did Boston fall victim to its own prejudices when it ignored the inconsistencies in his story and launched a manhunt that tore apart racially mixed neighborhoods? So that's something to think about, and there are differing opinions.
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that there were a lot of racial tensions in Boston at this time. Just a few years before, they had gone through desegregation with busing, forced busing.
Right,
and it was a mess.
Yeah.
And there is still a lot of smoldering resentment between the white and black communities.
Okay. See, I don't really remember that, but you do. So.
And then this came along.
Yeah.
And this just fanned the fuel.
This was a mess.
It was a huge mess.
Yeah. So it was a lot more than just a domestic murder.
Right.
I say just, but you know what I mean.
No, I know what you mean.
Yeah.
It was certainly more than that. It was a commentary on race.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's lots to talk about, but let's get that beer poured, and what have you got today?
We're in Boston.
Yes.
So I'm going with Sam Adams Boston Lager, which is brewed by the Boston Beer Company in Jamaica Plain. Now, I chose this one not because it's such a fantastic beer, but it's a historic beer.
I know.
The Boston Beer Company was started in 1984 by Jim Cook, who's a Harvard grad, had a few jobs, and decided in the early 80s that he wanted to have a beer company.
Oh, so it wasn't developed by Sam Adams?
No.
Okay.
Sam Adams, our patriot?
Well, or a guy named Sam Adams that likes beer.
No, it's Jim Cook. So it's one of the earliest, if not the earliest, craft brewery in New England. And this particular beer, Sam Adams Boston Lager, is their original beer, their first beer. This is a recipe that, by the story Jim Cook tells, is his grandfather's recipe. He found it in an attic.
Really?
And he brewed it, and he would take samples of it around to bars in an attempt to get the bar owners to use his beers or provide his beers.
But there wasn't much competition back then like there is now.
Well, yes and no. I mean, the competition back then was between all the macro beers, and so it was tough breaking in.
Oh,
he's a small brewery going up against the likes of Budweiser, Miller, and so on.
Now, was he adding wheat and extra stuff to his beer, or is this a true beer by German standards?
This is a true beer. It's a Vienna lager, which is named after the city where it originated.
Okay.
Okay, so it's an Austrian recipe.
Mm-hmm.
These types of beers have a three-step boiling process, which really gives you a very pleasant malt taste.
Mm.
And they tend to have subtle hops. They tend to be crisp with some residual sweetness. And this describes Sam Adams Boston Lager to a T. So I thought it deserved to pour into a pint glass.
Sure.
It's an amber color, thick white head, very pretty. Most beers are, though. It has a sweet roasted grain aroma.
Uh-huh.
Taste of caramel, very mild hops, light-bodied, easy drinking. A beer that, by today's standards, would be called sessionable, which means you can drink a fair amount of them in one sitting.
So it might be something you might want to buy a 12-pack of and just keep it handy for refreshment purposes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is a beer, I think, at this stage. I mean, you can't consider Sam Adams or Boston Beer Company a microbrewery anymore. They're a big, big, big brewery.
Right.
So it's probably, this beer is probably a beer that would be a gateway beer for non-beer drinkers to start getting their feet wet in terms of better crafted beers and hopefully going on from there.
Okay.
Boston Beer Company must have a couple hundred beers that they brew, maybe not all at the same time, but they're big.
Wow, yep.
So this is to Jim Cook and Boston Beer Company.
All right, cheers.
Cheers.
Okay, Dickie, let's take these pint glasses, and it's kind of noisy over here. I think down then and there it looks a little bit quieter. We can have a nice talk about the case.
Yeah, it doesn't look like anyone's sitting down there. Let's head down there.
Okay. So let's go over it a little bit to start. On October 23rd, 1989, Charles Stewart shot and killed his pregnant wife, Carol Stewart. His accusation that a black man was responsible caused major racial tensions, as we said, in the city of Boston. So after dinner at a restaurant 6 weeks before the shooting, Charles Stewart complained to a friend that he had noticed something new about his pregnant wife, Carol, that she had the upper hand in their marriage. And according to another friend, Charles was upset that his wife had refused to get an abortion, and he was worried that she would not return to her job as a lawyer after she gave birth, and this, of course, would lower their income. So this may be the closest anyone can get to understanding what was going on in the mind of Charles Stewart during this time.
Yeah, Charles earned a pretty good living working for a furrier.
He did.
But she's an attorney. She had more earnings potential than he did.
Right.
I mean, he wasn't ever going to be a partner in the firm or anything like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But she was going to be continuing to increase her income. So I can see the concern because she didn't want just one baby. She wanted more than one. So in his mind, he's going to lose the goose that laid the golden egg.
Well, maybe he should have thought about that before he married her.
Probably.
They probably weren't on the same page as far as what they wanted from the marriage.
Plus they wanted, or she wanted to move to a bigger home.
Mm-hmm.
And that was going to cost more.
Right.
So there's some pressure on Chuck here.
Sure. But we're not going to excuse him, my hope.
I'm not trying to excuse him.
Okay. All right.
I'm just looking at how he viewed it.
Right. Right. Yeah. Okay. Well, do you mind if I go over just a little bit of Carol's history?
Go right ahead.
Okay.
It'd be good to know.
Yeah. So Carol Stewart was actually born Carol DeMattis on March 26, 1959, in Medford, Massachusetts. She grew up in the warmth of a busy, large, extended Italian family, and she graduated from Medford High School, where she's remembered as an excellent student, hard worker, a really kind friend. She had her first job at age 15 as a bus girl, and was promoted to a waitressing position as soon as she turned 18 and she could serve drinks. So when she enrolled in Boston College in 1978, she'd actually saved almost $10,000 of her own money.
Which, back then, that was a lot of money.
Well, still is, but back then it was even more, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So Carol attended classes during the day, but she continued to work at the Driftwood restaurant and live at home with her parents. And she met Chuck Stewart at the Driftwood, where he was a short order cook. So Chuck told his co-workers that he'd been at Brown University, but a knee injury caused him to lose his football scholarship. Now, Brown didn't have football scholarships, but Chuck was determined to achieve social status, and he tended to make up stuff like that.
So he never went to Brown.
No, he didn't.
So he just made up the Ivy League claim.
And, he did.
And the Ivies don't give any sort of athletic scholarship.
No, he didn't know that.
So, but nobody called him on it.
No, I think most people liked him and just kind of let it go.
Yeah.
He
seemed to be a guy with the gift of gab.
Yeah, charming salesman type.
Right.
Yeah. His education actually consisted of high school vocational classes, and he flunked out of Salem State in less than 1 month there. So he wasn't much of a student.
Flunking out before the semester's over is, I think that takes a lot of effort.
Or lack of effort, maybe.
Right.
Yeah. Well, Carol broke up with her high school sweetheart to be with Chuck. And by the time Carol graduated college, she and Chuck were planning on getting married. So Chuck wanted to get married right away, but Carol insisted that they should wait until she finishes law school.
She's going to law school.
So she was a super practical type of girl, it seems.
She was.
Yeah.
It would seem they were kind of opposites there.
Yeah, but opposites can attract, right?
We know that.
Yes. We're a little bit opposite-ish. A
little bit.
A little bit. But we...
Not as much as you might think.
No.
No.
Okay. So now you get me all distracted. Chuck entered a management trainee program at Edward F. Caucus & Sons. Is it Caucus?
Yeah, I think Caucus.
Okay. Furrier. And I don't like that anyway. But within a year, he was a top salesman there.
Right. Like you said, he had the gift of gab.
He did. And he was motivated.
Yep.
So even though he wasn't much of a student, he was ambitious.
That he was.
Yes. Now, the couple was married in 1985, and they had good-paying careers, and they bought a duplex in Medford. Now, Chuck was in charge of the finances. He had extravagant tastes, buying his clothes from Brooks Brothers. And he liked to take trips with the guys, and he liked to go to Celtics and Patriots games, which can be expensive.
Yeah, that looks like they spent money pretty quickly. As fast as they made it, it went out.
Yeah, yeah.
He had really expensive tastes. He bought $1,000 suits. He ate out a lot.
Yep.
As you said, pro sporting events. I mean, these things were high-ticket items.
Sure, yeah. And not that Carol didn't spend. She spent also.
Right, but she was a little bit more practical. She was concerned that they couldn't keep spending this way, particularly if and when they had kids.
Yeah, she wanted to save and have a family.
Right.
And he didn't seem to want that.
I think that was the last thing he wanted.
Yeah, Carol really wanted a family. Even kids in high school said that was something she wanted way back then. And Chuck wanted to own a restaurant, so that was his big dream.
Mm-hmm.
And in the spring of 1989, Carol told Chuck she was pregnant, and Chuck signed up for a course on buying and operating a restaurant around the same time. So it seems like maybe they were kind of headed in different directions.
Maybe. I mean, his lifelong dream was to own a restaurant, run a restaurant, so that doesn't sound too different.
Well, it's kind of hard to do when you have a family, though, because you have to work those odd hours in the evenings, and it's hard to run a restaurant and raise a family at the same time.
It is.
Yeah.
I mean, you're running a restaurant, you're there the whole day.
It's a ton of work.
Ton of work.
And that's why a lot of them fail.
On hands work. And it'd be tough.
It would be. So they were kind of, I wouldn't say they were at odds, but they were kind of both leaning in different directions.
Right.
Yeah.
So that June in 1989, shortly after Carol told him that she was pregnant,
yep,
he became interested in a pretty college student named Debbie, who came to work at the Furrier with him in a summer job as an office assistant.
Yeah, and I don't know if that was a coincidence or if the fact that Carol was pregnant kind of turned him off and he'd moved on.
Yeah.
It seemed like he was kind of moving away from the marriage at that point.
It does, although Debbie says they never dated. She never broke up with her boyfriend. She never did anything inappropriate with Chuck.
That's what she said. But they did have proof that she called him quite a few times on his credit card.
When he was hospitalized, right?
Yes, yeah. And I don't know if that was just a friendly thing because she felt sorry for him or not.
So also that summer, Chuck asked his brother Michael and a friend of his, David McLean, to help him get rid of his wife. And these were on separate occasions. They weren't sitting down together discussing this.
No, they were separate occasions.
But he had two different people he was discussing this with.
Right.
Neither of them responded as he was hoping, and he later said, oh, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. Well, what's he going to say? Once they said, are you kidding? You must be crazy. You know,
said,
why don't you just get a divorce?
You're right. I'm just kidding.
Right.
I'm just fucking with you.
Yeah. Yep.
So in both of the conversations, he talked about his desire to open a restaurant.
Yep.
And that his pregnant wife was an obstacle to doing so.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. There's maybe some motive there.
Maybe. I think probably. Probably definitely. Because I think he didn't want her to be pregnant. If he actually asked her to get an abortion, how did he end up getting her pregnant? I mean, why would he get her pregnant if he felt that strongly about it?
I know.
Why didn't he get a vasectomy?
Well, or why didn't he use a condom?
Something.
I mean, he couldn't. It takes two to get pregnant, right?
I think so, as far as I remember.
Yeah. So, I mean, he could have, if he didn't want to become a father, there were things he could have done to prevent that.
Yes, I believe so.
So he didn't.
He didn't. But maybe to please her, he went along with it, and then when it happened, I don't know. It's just weird. It doesn't make a lot of sense, does it?
No.
It's a shame, really.
So at the time of the shooting, Carol and Charles Stewart were a young, affluent couple preparing for the birth of their first child.
Right.
And from all outward appearances, being very happy about the coming birth.
Yeah, that's what most people thought.
And when the shooting occurred, they were on the way home from a birthing class at Brigham and Women's Hospital.
Right. She was 7 months pregnant, I think.
7 months.
Yeah.
Oh, they took, or Chuck was driving.
Yes.
And he was taking a more or less circuitous route home.
Well, I think, at least in the Lifetime movie I watched, Good Night, Sweet Wife.
Well, we can always believe what they show.
Well, I'm thinking it was probably based on a true story, so.
Well, yeah, that's the key thing, based on.
Right. But what they had said is that he told her he was taking a shortcut, and then when she questioned him again, of course no one knows because it was only the two of them in the car.
Right.
That he'd made up an excuse that the Furrier van had broken down and something or other.
Yeah, so, now that wasn't in the book that was written.
No. Did the book give a reason why?
Just the shortcut.
Okay.
And he might have gotten a little lost.
Sure.
But it was apparently that he was trying to find a secluded place.
Well, yeah, he already had the place picked out because he talked to his brother. Yeah.
This is the other brother.
Yes, a different brother. He had two brothers, I think.
Two brothers and a sister.
Yep.
But this was Matthew, who actually did agree to help him.
Well, he didn't agree to help him kill his wife.
No. He agreed that they were going to run some insurance scam or something.
Yeah, and I think he kind of took advantage of Matthew because he knew that Matthew was making minimum wage.
Yep.
And he told him that he could make $10,000 in this.
Matthew was a much younger brother.
Yeah.
Looked up to his older brother, Chuck.
Right.
And would pretty much do whatever Chuck asked him to do.
Pretty much.
So, and Chuck didn't present it after being 0 for 2 and talking to the other brother and a friend about killing his wife. He didn't bother mentioning that this time.
Well, I think maybe he figured out that wasn't going to work.
Obviously.
Yeah. So he came up with this alternate plan.
He was coming up with this plan to scam the insurance company.
And his brother.
And his brother was on a need-to-know basis, and he wasn't needing to know anything.
Well, okay.
So the brother agrees to meet him.
Yeah, to pick up, the jewelry and the gun.
Right.
I don't know if he told them about the gun.
I'm not sure he did.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Massachusetts State Police dispatcher Gary McLaughlin was actually on the phone with Chuck for 13 minutes that night. So there seemed to be some putting him off, some kind of delaying when he called 911. He wanted help to take a while to get to him to make sure she was dead.
Well, I guess you could look at it that way.
She
was probably still alive. Well, she was still alive when they did actually find him. She was near death.
Yeah.
And was pronounced dead pretty quickly at the hospital.
Sure.
So that's one thing. He kept saying on the 911 call that he didn't know where he was.
Yeah, which I don't think was true.
He had to know where he was.
Right.
I mean, he could give an approximation where he was.
Yeah, well, the dispatcher asked Chuck repeatedly for a cross street or a reference point as several cruisers scrambled to try and find the couple's blue Toyota. And this was in Boston's Mission Hill neighborhood, which wasn't a great neighborhood. Lots of crime there.
Lots of crime, predominantly black.
Yes. And officers found the blood-soaked car, I mean, the seats were just covered in blood, near the intersection of St. Alphonsus Street and Horridon Way. So that's where it was.
Okay.
Yeah.
And just to be devil's advocate, I mean, Chuck shot himself and somehow made a mistake. Either his wife fell on him, or he aimed wrong, or something happened, and he inflicted a more serious wound on himself. So I could see maybe he didn't really remember where he was. He was bleeding profusely.
Well, he remembered the lie to say it was a black man.
Well, that part, sure. But, you know, he might have gotten disoriented and not known exactly where he was.
Yeah, I doubt it.
I do, too. But, like I said, I'm just playing devil's advocate here.
But he did shoot himself really badly.
He
did. He could have ended up killing himself, which would have been...
He almost did.
...funny in a very sick way. Yeah.
he barely missed his aorta.
Yeah, yeah.
I know he was trying to give himself a wound, kind of a flank wound.
Yes.
That was the idea, but it got aimed differently.
Well, the book we read, the guy implied that maybe Carol had tipped a certain way or something and bumped him so that he shot more into his abdomen than he planned on.
I mean, I can see here she is mortally wounded with a gunshot wound to the head, and she's up against the passenger side door.
Right.
And maybe she comes across the seat and jostles him just as he's getting ready to shoot.
Maybe, because his elbow had to be kind of out and towards her in order to get the angle anyway, right?
Right, because supposedly was a guy in the back seat.
Yeah, so he had to get his arm around kind of the back of him.
Yeah,
like
do a chicken wing type of thing and
get
the gun in the back.
Right, and he actually ended up losing part of his colon, didn't he? He had a colostomy when he died.
He had a colostomy. Well, he did. They were going to take it down. They had enough gut left that he wasn't going to need a colostomy bag forever.
No, it was temporary while it healed.
But he did have a bag on.
Yeah.
Which must have pissed him off.
Well, but just think, if he'd just given himself like a flesh wound, he probably would have been found out right away. Because they would have questioned friends and family and figured it out.
He would have.
Yeah. I think the only reason...
he would have been found out more quickly. I think he would have been found out eventually anyway.
You think so? Yeah.
Oh, no question.
Even if the brother didn't talk?
Even if the brother never said a word.
Oh, okay.
But we can talk about that.
Okay. Well, go ahead.
Right now?
Why do you think so?
Well, there are numbers of people that didn't think his story was consistent.
Okay.
And the people that lived in the neighborhood, first of all, thought a drug dealer, a drug guy looking to rob people for drug money.
Yeah.
Wouldn't shoot.
Wouldn't shoot at all.
He maybe would brandish a gun,
but
he wouldn't be shooting. And if he did shoot, he'd shoot the guy first. He's more of a threat than the woman.
Well, absolutely, yeah. I mean, so, especially a super pregnant woman.
Right.
Yeah.
So you've got that. You've got the stuff about not knowing exactly where he was, when he probably did know exactly where he was.
Yes, yep. But I don't think they would have known that unless his brother spoke. They might believe that he was lost because he wasn't from around there, right?
Right, he wasn't from around there.
So that might not have gotten him found out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And down the road, the other inconsistencies were, even when they made the arrest, they never found the sweatsuit that he was allegedly wearing. They never found the gun that he allegedly used.
No.
They never found or recovered any of the stolen articles that he allegedly took.
No.
So the case against the guy who they arrested was going to fall apart.
Willie Bennett.
Right.
Yeah.
Are you going to talk about him?
Yeah, a little bit. But, sure. Also, I think there were no witnesses that saw a guy by that description in the area.
Right.
And also, Chuck had said there were no people around, and one of the streets was quite crowded every night.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There probably were witnesses.
Yes.
Or potential witnesses, if he was truthful in where he was driving.
Another thing that he added to his story was that the guy had said he's 5'0 because he had a cell phone in the car, which was unusual in 1989.
Yeah.
That the perpetrator thought he was a cop.
Right.
And that's why he shot. But why would he shoot the woman then? Why wouldn't he shoot?
He'd shoot
Chuck.
The guy first.
You would think so.
Yeah.
So it was a little hinky of a story.
It was. And there were most of the people that were getting rousted by the cops didn't believe the story anyway. And there were some newspaper people that didn't believe the story, most notably at the Boston Herald, although they didn't hesitate to report all the juicy stuff that came up, but there were people that didn't believe the story.
Yeah.
And then the hospital staff just absolutely loathed him.
Yeah, his behavior in the hospital was reprehensible.
Right.
Yeah. So you're right, he probably would have been found out eventually.
No doubt.
Yeah.
The brother's confession just speeded up the process.
Yeah.
But they had a loser case against Willie Bennett.
They did. I think that's true. So Chuck, he was taken to Boston City Hospital, where he was in surgery for 6 hours. Carol was taken back to Brigham and Women's, and doctors delivered her son by C-section. Like we said, she was 7 months pregnant, right?
Yep, about 30, 32 weeks.
Yeah. So at 3 a.m., Carol died at the hospital, and this was the same hospital where she'd taken the birthing class 8 hours earlier, so that's kind of creepy.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
But they needed a neonatal unit.
Sure,
so yeah. They both couldn't go to Boston City.
No.
She needed to go to the nearest neonatal unit, which is Brigham and Women's.
Right, because they were right in that area. They'd just been there. Boston police, they searched for suspects, and it was all based on Stewart's description, of course. And investigating officers asked doctors, actually, if Stewart's wounds could have been self-inflicted, but they were told that it was very unlikely, like we said, due to the severity of his injuries. So those kind of saved him for a while, the severity.
For a while.
Yeah.
So accidentally he gave himself a worse wound.
Yes.
But it might have given him some time.
Yeah, I think it probably did.
And it was interesting that the cops were asking if it could have been self-inflicted, so...
Yeah.
I don't know whether they doubted his story or they're just being thorough in their investigation.
I think in any instance where there's a woman shot in the head and a man shot somewhere else on his body and he survives, you know, the husband or the boyfriend.
Yeah.
They're going to be suspicious.
Okay.
And the leading cause of death in pregnant women is murder, which is shocking but true.
Really?
Really.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and it's usually the father of the baby.
Okay.
Yep. So that doesn't say much for men. It's a bad statement on the male.
No shit.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. It was in December, so a couple months later, that police zeroed in on Willie Bennett. And he was an African-American. He was an ex-con, so he wasn't a good guy by any means. He was a criminal.
He was a career criminal.
Yes.
He'd never murdered anybody.
No, not that we know of.
Okay. He was never convicted of murdering anybody.
Right.
But he did brandish guns, he did robberies, he did drugs, he did a lot of crappy things. He'd been in and out of jail.
Yeah. I guess his nephew kind of jokingly bragged that he was responsible for the killing, and that got around in the neighborhood. And then the police got a statement out of the nephew saying that Willie had said he'd done it.
Right.
I mean, he did fit Chuck's description. And Chuck identified Bennett in a lineup eventually.
Eventually. It was tough. He looked at photographs first.
Yes, he did.
And finally said maybe one of these two guys.
Yeah, so do you think he was hesitant because he had a conscience and didn't want to put an innocent man in prison? Or do you think he was hesitant that he would pick someone that it couldn't have been?
Yeah.
I don't know.
he probably knew that they weren't showing him all perps.
You think so? Because he took a long time to make the ID.
And then even when he did the lineup, he wasn't real sure, and he finally settled on Willie.
Yeah.
Which made the cops happy.
Yeah, maybe they were kind of leaning him towards that.
They might have been.
Sometimes I think they do that.
And just going back, I mean, this followed weeks of harassment in Mission Hill and other black districts where cops would show up. They'd strip search any male that was walking around.
Yeah, they'd take teenage boys in their car.
Right on the street.
Scare them, yeah.
They'd drop your pants, pat them down. I mean, it was almost like a reign of terror.
Yes. Wasn't good for race relations at all.
No.
No.
And the mayor and the police commissioner condoned it.
Well, yeah. I think in the papers from the articles that I looked up, they were treating Chuck and Carol Stewart like they were just the perfect couple. They even called them the couple of Camelot.
Yeah.
They had the enchanted life that was ruined. And they were certainly saying, well, even the public was saying horrible things about, you shouldn't even go to Boston, it's so dangerous, you know. We need to get these scumbags. People went a little nuts over it.
Well, they did.
Yeah.
But I think that's part of the underlying problem, that there was still a lot of racial tension in that city.
Sure.
And it was really easy to blame a black guy for murdering a white woman and shooting her husband.
Yeah.
Very believable in that climate.
And something to think about was that there was actually a young black man killed that same night two blocks away, and nobody heard anything about that.
Nope.
No. Now, the nephew did recant his story soon after he gave his statement. He also claimed that the police had pressured him into the statement.
Right. And there were a lot of other people that initially felt they were pressured into testifying against Willie and later recanted.
There were a couple other people arrested even before Willie.
Yeah. So all this stuff against Willie was going to come to naught, because pretty much everybody who had been arrested or been interviewed that fingered him was going to recant or deny they ever had made those statements.
Right, right. Yeah, the case against Willie Bennett collapsed on January 3rd, actually, 1990. That's when Chuck Stewart's brother Matthew identified Chuck as Carol's killer. Matthew admitted that he'd driven to meet Chuck the night of the murder to help him commit what he'd been told was just a simple insurance scam for some money.
Right.
Yeah. And then when Matthew arrived at Chuck's car, he saw that Carol had been shot, that Chuck had shot himself to make it appear like a carjacking. And Matthew, you know, not knowing what to do at the time, he took the gun and the bag of valuables, and this included the couple's wedding rings, and he threw them off the Pines River Bridge in Revere.
Well, not all of it.
No, he did keep Carol's engagement ring.
He kept some.
Did he keep more than just the engagement ring?
Well, I know the engagement ring was returned to her parents.
Oh, okay.
Or looked, shown to her parents to identify.
Yeah, I thought that's the only item he kept.
I thought he just tossed the gun into the water and kept everything else.
Oh, okay. But we're not sure about that. But some of the items, including the gun, were later recovered from the water. And the first named suspect was Alan Swanson. He was a homeless black man who owned a black sweatsuit. Swanson was held for 3 weeks until police focused on Willie Bennett. So that certainly affected his life. 3 weeks is a long time to be in jail.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Police later learned that Chuck had been upset at the prospect of becoming a father, especially worried that his wife wouldn't return to work after the baby was born. Chuck had also started some sort of relationship with the young co-worker Debbie Allen, although, as we said, Debbie's denied any romantic involvement.
Right.
So maybe it was just a friendship with him having other ideas about it.
Possibly.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd still think that there was more to it than her denials. Why did she call him so frequently?
Yeah, I'm not sure. We don't know.
When he was in the hospital, I mean,
there could have been more to it, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he was decent looking. Although they said she had a really nice boyfriend, so who knows?
And I'm not sure I'd say he was decent looking, but, you know, it's just guy stuff.
Okay. All right.
And both newspapers in Boston, the Globe and the Herald, had a field day with this whole case.
Right.
They just went nuts.
It was on the front page day after day.
And there's a long-standing rivalry between the two papers. The Herald is more the tabloid type that would really play up cases like this, and the Globe was the more staid conservative paper that usually wouldn't do anything about this. But the Globe jumped into this case with both feet and really reported a lot of stuff.
Sure.
One of which was that he got a $480,000 check issued to Charles Stewart in payment for a life insurance policy on his
$480,000?
That's what it said, but no check was ever recovered.
Yeah.
The book said he got an $80,000 check.
Yeah, I think that they did confirm that.
And he was waiting for another $100,000 check.
Yep.
But before he got that, he killed himself.
Yeah, right.
And some of the strange things after he was out of the hospital, and I think actually when he knew that he was a suspect and was going to be arrested.
Yes.
He bought a new Nissan.
Oh, okay. I thought he bought the Nissan before he knew.
I guess that's true.
Yeah.
He bought the earrings. He bought a pair of diamond earrings.
Well, and that's what makes me think there was a little something going on with Debbie.
Yeah.
Or at least he thought so.
Or who else is he buying those for?
I don't know.
But that's the day before he killed himself.
Yeah, and he was in the store with another guy.
Yeah.
But we don't know who that was.
Nope.
Okay. Yeah, that's just weird. Well, in the movie, which I don't know if that's 100% accurate, but in the movie, he went and got his hair done and a pedicure and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
When he got out of
and
the hospital.
He did in the book, too.
Did he?
He called up his hairdresser and got squeezed in. And asked him when he was there, he needed to have his hair colored, even though he had very few gray hairs.
Yeah, the hairdresser thought he was strange. The hairdresser had said he was sorry about his wife and his baby.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, nobody who talked to Chuck thought he had any remorse or emotion following the shootings.
No. Probably not until he got caught.
Right.
He felt bad for himself.
For himself.
Yes.
I mean, the hospital staff thought, you know, he was on the phone all the time. He's talking about what he's going to do when he gets out of this.
Talking about buying a restaurant, right, buying property.
Making Christmas plans, all this stuff. He just wasn't acting like the bereaved husband.
And the baby was alive for a while, and he wasn't really interested in the baby or the baby's survival either.
No. Well, that baby really never had a chance because it was without oxygen for too long.
Yeah.
So it was born severely brain damaged.
Mm-hmm.
Had seizures his whole life.
Yeah.
And was dependent on a respirator to keep him alive.
Yeah.
So they eventually figured he had pretty much zero chance of survival and turned the ventilator off and the baby died.
Yeah. But still, he didn't seem to want to spend much time with the baby, which you think in that case, your wife's died. You've got this newborn, even if you know he's not going to make it,
yeah,
you'd want to spend some time with him.
He wasn't asking how the baby was.
And he wasn't a medical person. He probably, you know, a lot of people think there's a chance even when there's not.
Right.
And he didn't seem to even think that in the beginning.
No. He went over at the end when they withdrew life support
and
put on a big show of grief.
Disgusting.
Yeah.
Yeah. He is disgusting. But he really had no love for that child, obviously. He didn't even want the child to be there.
He didn't.
Yeah.
So there's a psychiatrist at Harvard, Robert Coles.
Yeah, I read a little bit that he had written in the Globe.
Right. And he believed Charles Stewart was an extreme example of a psychopath, or what we call sociopath. They're kind of the same.
Sure.
An antisocial personality with little sense of remorse and a propensity to lie and an ability to deceive others.
Sounds like him.
Sounds like some of the other husbands or women that we've discussed.
Yeah, I think a lot of killers are sociopaths, or they wouldn't be able to do it, right?
I would think so.
Yeah,
there's got to be something missing.
Sure.
To want to kill some other person.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, within 2 weeks of being released, he bought these diamond earrings, he bought a gold brooch, he got his hair done, he bought a car. So he was just wanting to start life over.
Mm-hmm.
He'd taken her clothes out of the closet, you know, just getting ready to move on.
Right.
Onward and upward. So on January 3rd, that's when Chuck learned that his brother was turning him in. And he met with his lawyer to try and get help. And he did tell him what he did. And the lawyer told him he needed a criminal lawyer. He couldn't represent him.
Right.
That he was like the family attorney that took care of finances and stuff.
He wasn't going to be able to help him.
No. So that's when Chuck fled. And he went to a hotel and spent the night in a hotel and woke up at 4:30 a.m. the next day. That's when he went down to the Tobin Bridge. He put his driver's license on the passenger seat. And he jumped into the Mystic River, killing himself.
Right.
Because
it was like it's an over 100-foot drop.
Sure.
From the level he was on to the water.
Certain death.
And it was January.
Ouch.
So it was colder than hell.
Yeah.
In that water.
Right.
So, yeah, he wasn't going to survive that.
No. On January 10th, divers found the revolver in the river, and tests revealed it to be the gun that shot Carol and Chuck. It was later determined that the gun was actually stolen from the safe at Cockus's Son Fur Shop, where Chuck worked.
Uh-huh.
So that's where he'd gotten the gun.
That's further evidence.
And I guess the guy, Cockus, Mr. Cockus, didn't know his gun was missing until later.
Well, they probably never looked for it.
Right.
So now, Chuck left a note.
Did he?
Yep.
What'd the note say? Where'd he leave it?
He left it in the car.
Okay.
And basically it just said, I'm sorry.
But he never took responsibility.
He never said, I'm sorry for killing my wife and child or anything like that. He just said, I'm sorry.
Okay.
And a couple other things, but no responsibility.
Okay, but you might say that the killing himself was an act saying he was responsible.
Sure. Yeah, I would say that, but he couldn't put it down in writing.
Right, right. Well, this case joined a long line of incidents that showed the city's less than adept handling on race relations.
That's right.
Comparisons were made between the Stewart case and the Central Park jogger case in New York, in which 5 innocent black men were arrested and charged after a young white woman was assaulted.
Yes.
Yep. And Mayor Flynn, the mayor of Boston at the time, he apologized to Willie Bennett's family, telling them that what took place was very unfortunate. But the Bennett family later said he stayed for only a couple of minutes and he wouldn't sit down when they offered him a seat.
Right. It was in the book. It was kind of a half-assed apology.
Well, he was probably nervous in their home, you know.
Okay.
Didn't want to sit on their furniture. You know, that's the kind of guy he was. So the family just wasn't really thrilled with the apology that they got. They didn't feel it was very genuine.
No, it wasn't, at least from the book that discussed the thing.
The thing?
The apology.
Right.
And the district attorney didn't come off too well either.
No.
He's the one that was behind all the ruckus in the black neighborhoods, looking at the black guys that didn't have anything to do with it.
Oh, right,
and he was pretty steadfast in his belief that Willie Bennett had done it, even though it was going to fall apart on him.
Yeah, well, the foolish consistency, right?
Right.
Yeah. Jack Levin, director of Northeastern University's Brudnick Center on Violence, told the Boston Globe, "The Stewart episode was extremely embarrassing for the Boston Police Department. The police and the citizens who believed this story have been disgraced." But he did say there was a more positive part of the legacy, that people are more sensitive to race afterward. So I'm not sure if that's true or not.
It might be, but I'm not sure it was just because of that incident. I think that just with time, race relations improve anyway.
Well, I mean, this situation could have set things back or brought things forward.
It could have set things back.
Yeah.
And nobody was rioting or looting or anything because of it.
No.
So.
Yeah, well, the falsely accused Willie Bennett, he gave a statement to the Boston Globe just in April 2000. And he said, "I don't trust anybody. I barely trust myself. The police falsely pinned a crime on me once, and they can do it again. I have no faith in law enforcement, and I don't like cops. Nothing has changed. You still have these same racist cops on the police force." But the thing is that Willie Bennett is in prison for other crimes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not a good guy.
Of course, he doesn't like cops anyway.
Right.
Right. And sadly, this all just makes me think that things haven't changed much when you think about the recent police shootings and the Black Lives Matter movement. I mean, are we making any progress, or is it something that's...
Well, the only thing I'd say for that is it hasn't happened in Boston, those kinds of shootings.
Yeah.
And I was just reading something when they were talking about all the shootings of unarmed black people, that there were instances in Boston where it could have happened, but the cops showed restraint and didn't shoot.
Okay.
So that might be something that's come out of it.
Yeah. Well, did they give some other training or something afterwards?
Oh, yeah.
They did?
Yeah.
Okay. And that seems to have made a difference.
Well, I don't know. I think the present leadership of Boston probably makes a difference.
Yeah.
In terms of the mayor and the cops, the police commissioner and stuff.
Right. Yeah, I suppose they would have a big effect on it one way or another.
For whatever reason, there hasn't been a similar occurrence in Boston.
But crime in Boston is at one of the lowest levels ever.
Yes.
Yeah, Boston's doing pretty well. I'm not afraid to go to Boston and hang out.
No.
No, it's a nice city.
I mean, there's still areas that you're not going to hang out in.
Sure.
But that's any city.
Right, right. Yeah, but you're not hearing about murders all the time in Boston.
No.
It's not like, you know, Chicago's really bad right now.
Right.
It doesn't seem to be like that.
No, there's a pretty good track record for Boston right now.
Yeah. Okay. So this was our second killer husband. Who do you want to do for the third one?
I think we should do Drew Peterson.
Ugh.
We're going to end up with a real scum.
He is such a scum.
Yeah.
He's despicable.
He is.
Yeah. And he actually had another conviction in 2015, so that should be an interesting one.
I'm thinking it will be.
Okay. Well, there certainly will be a lot of sound bites.
Yes.
Because he was quite the media whore.
Oh.
Yeah. He was really out there enjoying the attention.
Yes.
And you know who just had a field day with him was our girl Nancy Grace. Lots of interactions there. He was on Larry King. There's just all kinds of publicity.
Yeah, I've watched one of the Larry King interviews.
Yeah.
That was a puff piece.
Larry King was?
Larry King.
Yeah. I don't think he really got down to anything.
Nancy Grace went after him a little bit more.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
She hated that bastard.
We'll talk about that in a couple days.
Yeah. Yeah. She really hated him. Okay. So, are you tired of being a link in the corporate chain?
I am.
Tired of government and conglomerate-owned podcasts pushing their conformist agenda into your tender eardrums?
Power to the people.
Revolt, rebel. Make a stand against tyranny by supporting independent podcasts run by forward-thinking people such as Dick and myself.
I'm into that.
So if you join Team Tie Grabber, you collect your perks, you can tell Wall Street to suck it. Then we can move forward in a new path to freedom, and we can all move forward together.
That's it.
So if you want to join Team Tie Grabber, just go to our website, www.tiegrabber.com, and go to Team Tie Grabber Perks. You make your pledge, you get your gift, and everybody will be happy.
And you're putting it to the man.
That's right. Stick it to the man.
All right.
So you can listen to True Crime Brewery on Stitcher, on Google Play, and of course on iTunes. Give us a like on Facebook if you're kind enough. And we always like to get 5-star reviews on iTunes. Now, if you're not listening on iTunes, like I said, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @TieGrabberPods. Or you can follow us on Instagram, TieGrabberPodcasts. And as always, thank you for listening.
Thanks, boys and girls.
All right. Bye-bye.